Yesterday we were reading the Mangalacharana, and we completed the first five verses, so we'll begin today from verse 6. This is quite a striking verse. It's quite a striking verse of the nature of adhikari. Yesterday we talked about the anubandha chatushtaya, and first part of that was adhikari, that in the Mangalacharana it is not uncommon that the author will include some description about who the book is intended for. So here, Srila Jiva Goswami does that in a quite vivid way. Only those who have no desire other than to worship the lotus feet of Lord Krishna should read this book. Everyone else I warn off with my curse. Yes. So this book is not meant to be just one of these philosophical books suggesting different ideas for the purpose of discussion or anything like that. This book is meant to present Krishna. By this book I'm meaning actually the entire Satsandarbhas. Yeah. Tattva Sandarbha is an introduction to the Satsandarbhas. So in the Satsandarbhas, Srila Jiva Goswami wants to present Krishna. Krishna is the absolute truth. Everything is connected with Krishna. The goal of life is to realize one's relationship with Krishna and to come to the point of love of God. So this book is intended for that type of person then, the devotees and the aspiring devotees. Everyone else, he says, I warn off with my curse. You know, actually it's a fact that in Tattva Sandarbha, because Tattva Sandarbha is kind of setting the scene really to the rest of the six Sandarbhas, establishing the basis from which we're going to work in the six Sandarbhas, how are we going to work, what we're going to refer to, and defining in at least simple terms, introductory terms, what we're going to be talking about. So we do find in Tattva Sandarbha that Jiva Goswami, he does do a little bit of debating and arguing. We'll see that in the second section. There's the Praman section, which we're going to be beginning shortly, which will establish how Srimad Bhagavatam is the authoritative source of knowledge. And then the Prameya section, which begins around about verse 28 or so, 29, around about there, is going to be defining what is the tattva, what is the truth which Srimad Bhagavatam is talking about. So in that section, the second half more or less of the book, then Jiva Goswami is going to be discussing particularly Mayavad, a little bit of Mayavad, a little bit about Buddhism, because that was still prevalent to some extent when Jiva Goswami was present. I mean, in India. Nowadays you hardly find it really in India being practiced. But it was a little bit there when he was present. However, mainly it's the Satsandarbhas are there to glorify Krishna, describe Krishna, and how to approach Krishna in many, many ways, and very beautifully. So therefore the book is intended for the devotees, those who are serious. he says here, Bhajanai ka bilash van. Those whose abilash, their eka abilash, their only desire is Sri Krishna Padam Bhoja Bhajan, to worship and serve Krishna's lotus feet. And then the others, the non-devotees, he says that you please don't touch this. And he puts it very strongly, that I'm warning you not to touch this, otherwise you'll get into trouble. So we might think this is sort of overdoing it a bit. Why does he have to be so strong and so heavy, really? In fact, it's super heavy, isn't it, to talk about cursing anyone. Thing is that Jiva Goswami, actually he is being merciful, really. He's being merciful. Because these people, just like you know, we have our 10 offenses, and the 9th offense is to preach the glories of the holy name to the faithless. The reason being that those who are really faithless, if you try to preach to them, then it'll tend to make them worse. They'll become more agitated and more anti-Krishna and commit more offenses. So better just to neglect them. In fact, in his commentary on the 11th canto of Srimad Bhagavatam, Srila Jiva Goswami, that's the Krama Sandarbha. There, in the second chapter of the 11th canto, where the three levels of devotees are described, Kanishta, Madhyam, and Uttama Adhikaris, starting around verse 40-odd or so. So when the Kanishtas are described, then, of course, there are different types of Kanishtas, and there's, Jiva Goswami talks about a Kanishta who is sort of hardly really a Kanishta. He's very materialistic, and he just cannot distinguish between the devotees. He maybe doesn't even take the devotees seriously. He just thinks that it's me and Krishna, and I'm great. I'm really a great devotee. And all these other devotees, he doesn't take them seriously. So such a low-class devotee, Jiva Goswami says, that the right way to treat him or her is neglect them. Just don't deal with them. Yeah. So, like this, Jiva Goswami doesn't want to deal with these people because he doesn't want these people to read his book, because if they do, it's just going to agitate their minds more and make their situations worse. You know, there are parallels also, just like we're coming up now to the month of Damodar, and on the Diwali day, the 7th of November, that is the day that Damodar pastime took place, and Krishna delivered Nalakuvara and Manigriva, who had been cursed to become trees. So it's very clearly described there. Narada Muni cursed them. And he was not just being uptight or something like that. But he felt this is the only way to help these people. So similarly, Jiva Goswami is feeling that, you know, as far as this book is concerned, that type of envious person, atheistic person, that the best thing I can do for them is just tell them not to read the book. Yeah, so he says like that. And, oh, of course, in Chaitanya Charitamrita, you may know, there's one verse. I don't have the reference for it here, but it's there, where Krishnadas Kaviraj Goswami says that this book can only be understood by the devotees and not, he says, by the pig-like non-devotees. And he says, I'm very happy about that. I'm glad they can't understand. And even in Bhagavad Gita, that is, what is that? Chapter 18, verse 67. Krishna says, this knowledge should not be explained to those who are not austere or devoted or engaged in devotional service. So it's the same idea, basically. But Jiva Goswami is really expressing himself only. So then, on to verse 7. This is very clearly of the Namaskar variety of Mangalacharana verse. Offering obeisances to the teachers. Now I bow down to my initiating spiritual master and to my spiritual masters who taught me the meaning of Srimad Bhagavatam. Having done this, I declare my desire to present this encyclopedic work, Bhagavat Sandarbha. We mentioned yesterday about the use of that term, Bhagavat Sandarbha. So, one interesting point here is that he is doing something here which is not exactly strictly in terms of what Krishnadas Kaviraj Goswami says is there in a Mangalacharana, which, you know, is not a problem at all, but it's an interesting point. He is taking a vow. He is taking a vow that I declare my desire to present this encyclopedic work, this vast work. This is common practice, actually, in sacrifice, Vedic sacrifices, that whoever is the priest who is to perform the sacrifice, at the beginning, it is very common that he will express what they call his sankalpa. His sankalpa, his desire, his determination that I will complete this sacrifice, come what may. And in fact, there is a practice that even if the priest is a householder, he will accept a danda for the duration of the sacrifice to indicate his complete surrender and, you know, like he's just going to do it and that's all there is to it. Yeah. And nothing's going to come in his way. He's absolutely determined. So Jiva Goswami is doing that here. Now, yeah, we made a little note here in the points under commentary defining the term Sandarbha. So Srila Baladev Vijayabhushan, in his commentary on Tattva Sandarbha, on this verse, he gives a definition. And if you remember, we wrote the points which make up the definition on the board. I hope you wrote them down. I'll read this verse. Gudar tasya prakashas cha sarokti shreshtata tata nanarta vatvam vedyatvam sandarbha katyate buddhai. The wise call a composition a sandarbha when it elucidates a deep subject matter. We wrote that on the board. When it focuses directly on essential details. When it is excellently composed. When it conveys various complex ideas. And when it is readily understandable. So we wrote those points on the board. I hope you wrote them down. If not, and if you would like them, why don't you just look over the shoulder of someone sitting near you who may have written them down. So, yeah, this sandarbha then, for something to be a sandarbha, is not just an ordinary thing at all. In fact, there are not many books which are called sandarbhas. It means a very exacting type of philosophical presentation, done very carefully, very, very clearly, with great attention to detail, but clearly in the sense also that it can be as easily understood as possible. This is what a sandarbha is. All right. Then text 8, the last text in the... This is an important text because here he is really defining the subject matter in a little more detail. Lord Krishna's abstract feature of pure spiritual existence often goes by the name Brahman in the texts of the Vedas. His partial expansion as the Lord of creation regulates the material nature, Maya, and exerts his control through further personal expansions. A single manifestation of his personality, called Narayan, rules sovereign in the transcendental sky beyond this universe. May that same Sri Krishna, the Supreme Personality of Godhead, be pleased to grant pure love for himself to those who worship his lotus feet in this world. So there we have Brahman, Paramatma, and Bhagavan. And then we have Krishna as the last word in the Bhagavan feature, or even more clearly, as we mentioned, I think, on the first day, that he is the source, the original Bhagavan. Krishnastu Bhagavan Swayam. All those other expansions, all those other persons who this term Bhagavan can be applied to, like Narayan. Narayan is specifically mentioned here as being the most important form of the Lord in the Vaikuntha realm specifically. So Narayan is just a part of Krishna. Krishna is actually that original Bhagavan. So may Krishna then be kind enough to help the devotees and to give the devotees pure love of God, those devotees who are really trying, they're really trying to approach him and surrender to him and serve him like that. So let us go on then into the text itself. We said today we would read verses 9, 10, and 11. So let us just read through them. Just read through the translations. As you can see, from now on, Jiva Goswami's writing is in the form of prose. He quotes verses, but he himself is writing in prose. All right, so now we're beginning section 2. Section 2, the general idea there, is to establish Srimad Bhagavatam as the supremely authoritative source of knowledge. And from this goes on from verse 9 to verse 18. By the time we finish verse 18, then this goal has been achieved. Anyway, for the time being, subsection A we have called "The Vedic Literatures Are the Best Evidence." So I'll just read through all the translations right now. Text 9, the previous verse, verse 8, which we just briefly discussed, has alluded to a few topics, just very briefly mentioned or indicated, four things, in fact. Krishna, then Sambandha, or the relation between Sri Krishna and the words that describe him. The special understanding of the term sambandha, not the normal, or at least, you know, the more common type of understanding that we might have. Abhideya, what is enjoined to be done, or in other words, the recommended practice of worshipping him, and prayojana, the final goal, which is love for him. Before we can elucidate these topics, we must first settle the question of praman. That is, we must determine a reliable means of ascertaining facts. Where are we going to get our information from? To start with, an ordinary person's means of knowing, sensory perception and so on, are imperfect. They are tainted by his four defects, beginning with incorrect judgment. And moreover, they are simply inadequate for establishing contact with a reality whose nature is supramundane and inconceivable. Text 10. Therefore, direct perception and so on are unreliable sources of valid knowledge. We want to understand that object which transcends everything and is the shelter of everything and whose nature no person can conceive or imagine. For this purpose, our source of knowledge can only be the Vedas, which are comprised of non-material sound. The Vedas alone should be our praman. There should be a full stop there, sorry, after sound. The Vedas alone should be our praman, because they are externally self-manifest. And from them, in fact, have been derived all departments of knowledge, mundane and spiritual, among all schools of thought in human society since time immemorial. And text 11. The conclusion stated in text 10 is corroborated in such statements as the following. From Vedanta Sutra 2.1.11. Because logical conjecture is never conclusive. Then from the Mahabharata. Logic cannot explain things that are inconceivable. Then again from Vedanta Sutra. Because scripture is the source of knowledge about the absolute truth. And then again from Vedanta Sutra. Because revealed scripture, on the other hand, is based on Shabda Praman. And then a verse from Srimad Bhagavatam, spoken by Uddhava. For the forefathers, demigods, and human race, O Lord, the Vedas are your own perfect eye. They are the best instrument for seeing what cannot ordinarily be perceived, and for ascertaining the goals and means of progressive life. So, in this way, Jiva Goswami establishes that the Vedic literatures are the best evidences. Now, you'll see on the board here, we have written 10 terms. So, well, actually in our little brief notes there, in the commentary for text 9, we mention 10 types of pramans. So there they are. First of all, though, of course, we should mention about the four defects of the conditioned souls. I assume you know what they are. Make mistakes, to be illusioned, to cheat, and to have imperfect senses. So, the human beings, he mentions in text 9, are not good sources of knowledge. Brahma, B-H-R-A-M-A, means to make mistakes. Pramada, to be illusioned. Vipralipsa, to have the cheating tendency. And Karanapatava, to have imperfect senses. Then in his commentary on this verse, and in his commentary on this verse, verse 9, Jiva Goswami lists out these 10 that traditionally These are 10 pramanas. They can all be considered pramans, or possible sources of knowledge. And we're going to explain what each one is, of course. But just write them down for the time being. Hope you can read my... So the first one, have got them? All 10? First one is pratyaksha. It means direct perception. As we go through the remaining 9, you'll see that other than the third one, shabda, all the others really, they are actually dependent on pratyaksha. Yeah. Direct perception. You see it, you hear it, you touch it like that. However, we have just heard how, because of the defective nature of the human condition, direct sense perception is not really so reliable. In fact, Jiva Goswami has written it off already. Yeah. However, in a very general sense, if you consider what are different means by which we could acquire knowledge, then certainly direct perception is such a thing. Pratyaksha. Then Anuman means inference. You can infer something. It follows on. There's a classic example given in Nyaya. This is logic, in other words, inference. You take one statement and then try and expand it to come to a certain conclusion. So in Nyaya, there is a 5-stage system for constructing an argument to bring you to a certain conclusion. So the famous example is, classic example, there is first of all, because we haven't really got time to go into all the details, but first of all, there is a claim. First of all, you make a claim. So the classic claim is, there is fire on the mountain. That is the claim. Then, the second stage is to state the observed fact which is meant to prove it. In the case of this example, the reason is that there is smoke. Then, the next stage, the third stage, is like the general premise, that second, the observed fact is called the hetu. Did I say that? The first part, the claim, is called pratigya. I don't know if I should write these things on the board for you. So, first of all is the claim, pratigya. Then the observed fact, which is meant to prove it, the hetu. Then the general premise, the general basis upon which we are meant to understand it, vyapti. And that is that wherever there is smoke, there is fire. Sounds pretty reasonable, isn't it? It should do, because this is the classic example used in Nyaya, which means Vedic logic. That wherever there is smoke, there is fire, as in a kitchen. That is called the general premise, the general understanding, vyapti. Then fourth is, the reason is to be is confirmed, then there's a confirmation. Yeah, there's a confirmation that is called upanayana. And what is that in terms of this example? Yes, indeed. On the mountain, there is smoke. This is a form of a syllogism, if you're familiar with Western logic. Confirmation, yes, indeed. There is, on the mountain, there is smoke. And then, there is the conclusion. Nigamana. Nigamana, the conclusion. Therefore, there is fire on the mountain. Sounds reasonable, doesn't it? This is inference. This is the system, the Vedic system. In Western logic, they use the same system, but in three stages normally. The classic is, all men are mortal. Socrates is a man. Therefore, Socrates is mortal. If you ever studied philosophy at university, you would have heard that. It's a syllogism. Yeah. So this is a little more complex form. So now, of course, this sounds pretty good. Inference. You could kind of develop your argument and come maybe to some conclusion like Krishna's the Supreme Personality of Godhead. But there is a problem because this is based on pratyaksha. Is based on pratyaksha. So what if what you think is smoke is actually a cloud? Then your whole syllogism falls away. Or what happens if on the other side of the mountain where the fire was, they just had a heavy rainstorm for a few minutes, and the fire just went out, and when fires go out, you know, you get a lot of smoke at the end. So because of the problem with pratyaksha, therefore inference is not always 100% reliable. Particularly, you know, with subjects which are inconceivable, as in this case. Then there is shabda. There are two types, as written up there. Paurusheya and apaurusheya. Shabda, very, very literally, means the words of a reliable authority. You know, we may see different translations of it, which are valid. Contextually, they'll be valid. But, you know, in a dictionary sense, shabda literally means the words of a reliable authority. So now we've said here there are two types. One is paurusheya. That means the words of some reliable, mundane authority. Then there is apaurusheya. The words coming from some supramundane, transcendental personality, liberated personality. Yeah. So in due course of time, we'll see that it is the apaurusheya shabda which we are going to accept. And the Vedas are the best example of that in due course of time. For the time being, though, let's just go through the rest. Number four, Arsha. Arsha means the sages. There have been many sages mentioned in the Vedic literatures, particularly. So, that is another type. It is a type of shabda, actually. Anyway, let us just say it is a type in its own right. Then number five, upaman, analogy. Analogy. Oh yeah. So the classic analogy is that there is a creature called a gavaya, which is similar to a cow. If you're going into some area where they have gavayas, and someone from the area tells you, oh yes, they're like cows. Then when you go to the area and you see this creature and you see it has some resemblance to a cow, then you may realize, oh yes, this is a gavaya. So anyway, that is analogy. Then number six, artapati, means negative inference. In other words, this is a form of anuman actually, but it is a particular form, so it's presented on its own. Negative inference. There is a classic example. You may meet a sort of overweight person, heavily built person, and they may notice that you are looking at them and observing the fact that they're overweight. Then they may say to you, this is the classic example from Nyaya, they may say that, oh, I don't eat during the day. So then you can negatively infer that they eat at night. You know, of course we don't have so much time, but Srila Prabhupada's sister, Pashima, she used to do this. Prabhupada talks about it. You know, she was a small, round lady. And she was very nice. I met her a few times, and very, very nice. Didn't speak any English, but very nice devotee, and very dedicated to Prabhupada. And sometimes Prabhupada would ask her, even in front of his disciples, why are you so fat? There's one account, Shrutakirti gives it, of how once during a darshan, Prabhupada was talking about something related, and he pointed to his sister, who didn't speak a word of English, and said, just like my sister, she's so fat, but she says she hardly eats anything. So we could negatively infer from that she is very charitable to herself. Which, you know, people who have bad habits often are. Anyway, so that is artapati. If a fat person says they never eat during the day, you can negatively infer they must eat at night. Then abhava, non-existence. Non-existence. So the idea is, let's just see. There may be a book on the table. Then you come back 5 minutes later, the book is not on the table. So, the non-existence of that book, you know, that is a praman, that is an evidence that you can then say that, yes, someone stole it or someone took it, something like that. Then, sambhava, inclusion, that this is a type of evidence, a source of knowledge. If someone says, oh, I have 1,000 rupees, then by inclusion, you can understand he has 100 rupees also. Yeah. So, you know, I mean, that may sound a little sort of overly obvious, but, you know, it could be applied in the sense that if someone says that I'm going to some, like, the Radharaman temple, then you would say, oh, then you would know that, oh, you're going through Loy Bazaar. So then you could say, oh, could you stop at the shop and get me something? So it's a type of evidence then. Yeah. Inclusion. Then atihaya means tradition. Tradition. In a very broad sense, or particularly in the sense where you don't know the reliability of the source. Yeah. You know, in Vrindavan, you get a lot of that. When you're on parikrama, when you pass that well, right, just as you're approaching the road there, you know, sometimes you meet one of the local enthusiasts, and they tell you, you have to go around the well, otherwise your parikrama is not complete. And then you have to shout down the well, Radhe, Radhe. So this is, it's not a bad idea, of course, but this is a tradition. It means like a folk tradition. It's in that type of sense. And not exactly like sampradaya, tradition in that sense. Then there is cheshta, finally, means a gesture. Literally, it means pointing, excuse me. But, you know, if you point to something there, see? That is a way of establishing knowledge. There it is. It can also mean symbols, like Mr. Churchill in the Second World War, he had his V for victory symbol. Even the mudras, which pujaris do, they're symbolical gestures of the hands to indicate something. So there's a transmission of knowledge there. So these are the 10 types of pramans. Now, let's see. Some of them can be grouped together. Jiva Goswami says that anuman, see, just for your information at this point, the first three we accept, okay? As Vaishnavs, we accept pratyaksha, anuman, and shabda. But when we say shabda, we mean apurusheya shabda, that transcendental sound, authoritative knowledge. Under anuman, you can include upaman, artha, artapati, sambhava, and cheshta. Under pratyaksha, you can include abhava. And shabda can include arsha, and atihakli. So anuman can include number 5, upaman, artapati number 6, sambhava number 8, and cheshta number 10. Pratyaksha can include number 7, abhava, non-existence. Shabda can include arsha and atihaya, number 4 and number 9. I think it'll be self-evident if you just read through them. Yeah, how they can be included like that. So, we accept pratyaksha, anuman, and shabda. Particularly shabda, and particularly apurusheya shabda, that information coming from the transcendental realm. Purusheya shabda, even if it's authoritative, may not always be reliable. And it cannot be reliable when it comes to things transcendental. Purusheya, because it means knowledge coming from mundane people. So even if they're authoritative mundane people, it can't help you with anything transcendental. I can see we're going to have to carry on with this tomorrow. Anyway, that's okay. I'll just give you an example which Gopi Parat me. He said in 1945, Ronald Reagan, if you remember him, one of the recent presidents of America, he was an actor in those days. He did a television advertisement acting as a doctor. He had on, you know, the white gown or the trappings of a doctor, perhaps with a stethoscope around his neck, something like that. And he did an advertisement for cigarettes. And the idea was that at that point, of course, they didn't know so much about cancer yet, lung cancer. But the research at that point apparently showed that smoking was good for you. Some research done by some scientists. They hadn't got the idea yet about cancer. But Mr. Regan got up, dressed as a doctor, and said, "We doctors, we recommend you smoke. It's good for your health." This is a fact. And it was coming from Porusheya authority, scientists. And unfortunately, it all fell to pieces a little while later. But anyway, so we accept Aporusheya Shabda. That knowledge which is coming from beyond us. All these other systems, they are based on the human perceptive powers. If you look at them all, you'll see they're all based on that, including Porusheya Shabda. So we'll continue with the discussion tomorrow, which is meant to establish why we accept a Porusheya Shabda. Any comments or questions? Text 9. Oh, you mean text 7. Text 7. So you want me to explain the significance of the initiating spiritual master function? Yeah. It's not exactly part of the course. It's sort of, you know, like a given, an accepted, like existent, meant to be an accepted existent reality. But the basic point is to officially connect one with the Sampradaya. Yeah. Through the process of initiation, which is a process of, in the presence of the deity, in the presence of the parampara, in the presence of the devotee community, officially linking the initiated person with the Sampradaya. Yeah. If you take it down to its most raw form, is the function. And then deity worship is performed, can then be performed, at least after second initiation, which is like, you know, the real initiation or more substantial initiation at least. Then through being officially connected to the Sampradaya in that way, by the authorized representative of the Sampradaya, then the Sampradaya, if you then, the initiated person, worships the deity, then the members of the Sampradaya will accept the service and see that it's offered to Krishna. You know, if you don't mind, that's about as far as I'd like to go, because it's not exactly part of the course. Well, we'll talk a bit more about some of the others, like we mentioned, for example, Arsha. Tomorrow we'll talk a little bit more, perhaps. Authority of sages. Now, the thing is that there are different types of sages. They're not all devotees. Yeah. Jaimini, Kanada, you know, these are very prominent sages, but they're not devotees. So, the knowledge coming from these sages in general, come under into the category of Shabda, or specifically Aporusheya Shabda. It may or may not. You know, for one thing, see, it wouldn't necessarily be considered Shabda, because Shabda is meant to be authoritative. Now, some of these people, like Charvaka, he's a sage, but he's talking nonsense. So, he can be called a sage, and what he is presenting could be called Arsha, but not Shabda, because Shabda means it's authoritative, and what Charvaka says is not. And various of these others also. They have got kind of illusory philosophies, even though they're accepted as sages. Now, where a sage is a pure devotee and he is speaking, then it is not Arsha. It's a Parusheya Shabda. It's Shabda. Yeah. And then tradition also. You know, we have certain things which are traditional. Like one devotee asked Prabhupada once, why do we not pick Tulsi on, is it Ekadasi or Dwadasi? One of the Dwadasi, okay. Srila Prabhupada said, because Sanatan Goswami says so in Hari Bhakti Vilas. He didn't say that, you know, this reason and maybe Tulsi's not feeling so well or, you know, some sort of attempt to explain. Or there's a famous conversation between Prabhupada and I think Siddha Swarup and one or two other kind of, you know, speculator devotee disciples he had about the statement in Krishna book that King Ugrasena had, what was it? 10 quadrillion personal bodyguards. You know, we only have 5, or I believe it's now up to 6 billion humans on the planet. So these devotees, actually they were kind of, you know, critical, really. But they were trying to make it look like that they were making a genuine inquiry. That, you know, how could he have 10 quadrillion bodyguards? They were just the bodyguards. Probably, you know, each one or the majority of the 10 quadrillion had families also. You know, a wife and 1, 2, 3, 4 children or something. And that's just the bodyguards. What about the rest of the army? The rest of the population? And they said, you know, wasn't it overcrowded? Or how could it be true? And Srila Prabhupada, he very pointedly avoided any form of explanation. He said, we accept that because it is in Srimad Bhagavatam. And they were saying that, well, you know, we're trying to preach and, you know, and people ask us and we should, you know, can't you help us? Something we can say to them. But Prabhupada could understand they were being critical, trying to find fault. So he just smashed them and said, this is in Srimad Bhagavatam, we just accept it. So we may have things which are kind of traditional understandings, but that's part of Shabda. It's part of Shabda. But where you get in a very general sense something which is a tradition, like a folk tradition, then it may or may not be valid. So therefore we don't include it under Shabda.